Okay, so this is the three principles of data science, which kind of it's kind of a summarization of what I've been trying to do as a data scientist or statistician over the last 10 years. So let me share my view of data science, of pretty much is the Berkey view of data science. We think data science is the reemerging of computational statistical thinking in the context of domain problems. It's very much reflected in our curriculum. You have these three components: computer science, maths, and stats, and domain knowledge and data science. Some people say it's intersection, others say it's union. But I do think as a team, you should have all three covered. And the claiming of the reemerging is because this little story, or big story, like statistician Herman Harowith was a statistician in the U.S. Census Bureau. 1890, it was predicted that the U.S. Census would take 13 years, and it would be too long because every 10 years. So he was charged to speed up the computation. As a result, he invented the Harowith tabulating machine, which is was one of the four companies that formed IBM. So that was really a good example that statistics drove computation. And now we're kind of back again. It's like when Berkey got Simon's Institute, I was talking to them saying, like, you cannot imagine computing without data and data without computing. These two just have to couple. And of course, the domain, I mean, one of the modern founders of statistics, R.A. Fisher, was very much driven by statistical genetics, to a certain extent, the evolution theory of Darwin, and also Galton, and also Carl Pearson, was very much trying to give a mathematical foundation for Darwin's evolution theory. And we're kind of coming back together, the stat and ML, in the sense that statistics will also kind of work with science on the interpretability, mechanics, explanations of things, try to bring statistics into science. And ML is kind of coming through a very successful period of prediction, also facing the same problem, interpretability. And EU's General Data Protection Regulation last year really gives a right to explanation and demands this algorithm to be human interpretable. And cross-validation has been really helpful to avoid overfitting in certain most of cases, so not all, but it really doesn't really address explanation problem. And I have been kind of trying to bring stability as a unified framework to bring many things together to address reproducibility and interpretability. And on one hand, it builds on the stability of knowledge. It's like self-evident, I would say, principle that knowledge is stable. And somebody actually gave me a quote recently, can go back to Plato in his dialogue, Meno, speaking that opinions don't have to be tied down, but knowledge has to be tied down, means it has to be stable. So it's a very common sense thing we shall have. And actually, if you look at central limb theorem, which is, it's really a stability result. If you look at Lindbergh swapping trick, that's not how I learned central limb theorem, but Terry Stahl has a nice 7 different ways of proving central limb theorem. And the modern, a lot of random matrix result, actually through a perturbation technique to prove limiting result. So it's really a fundamental strategy too. And jackknife, which is delete one, and we in machine learning people call arithmetic stability, and has been a lot of result connecting with generalization error, model selection, lasso, clustering, causal inference, and differential privacy, all have this stability kind of angle to it, or can be interpreted through the framework. So I kind of try to put together, call that stability principle as a minimum requirement for scientific reproducibility and interpretability. So when you apply this stability principle, you need to, the user, specify what are the appropriate perturbations. So you have to take the context into account to prove it's appropriate. So that's a very heavy duty word, either data or models. And you define your stability measure. So for prediction, actually, use cross validation, it's pretty stable. And deep learning the same way. But deep learning, you cannot interpret the parameters, right? Just too unstable, it's very redundant. So you define that and you discuss the stability. An example data perturbation in the IID case, cross-validation I mentioned, bootstrap subsampling, you can add amount of data, Leo Braman did, to data, and you can feed the model, take the residue, and then do the perturbation. But one form, I think it doesn't come from statistical machine learning yet, is actually we should really incorporate also model-based, mechanistic model-based simulations as a form of data perturbation. Actually, Peter Abuse group at Berkey, they actually do this robotic arm reaching to an object. It's a lot of for human to do that and record. So what they did, they added data which is simulated from PDE models for the arm reaching and really helped the result. So this is trying to build a platform, include the traditional ones, but also for us to entertain ones which hasn't been dealt with. And model perturbation. So this, the paper, actually stability was my Tukey lecture for Bernoulli Society like 4 years ago. So I was trying very, very hard to connect sample stability with Tukey's robust statistics. And I realized that we now have so many different models, right? Robust statistics saying, I want a method which work under both models, like Laplacian and Gaussian. And semi-parametric models, like I leave a big part which is just very vaguely defined, say, only second moment or some smoothness. So it's kind of stability.
So, I mean, in statistical physics,
yes,
many interesting things happen at phase transitions. And there actually the model is not very stable.
Exactly.
So how do you deal with that in your kind of...
Actually, I have a kind of a project with a postdoc at Berkeley, Shanshindu Gandhi.
Shanshindu.
Yeah, we have been talking about that. My conjecture, he also agrees that actually we don't have stability there.
Yeah.
So I'm actually want to work with him to prove that it doesn't. So that's where it's almost impossible to do the traditional statistics. Yeah, exactly. So we're talking, we have been meeting. Yeah. So exactly, I agree with you. Yeah. So that's not a regime we do a lot of statistics. I can imagine that maybe there's certain particular projection or something might be doable. I don't know, but in general, it's probably like it's the same thing as the AR model. When you have the coefficient at a unit circle, you already have that. Yeah, it's a much simpler model than stochastic, than a statistical physics model. And in regression, simple regression, open phase, do you do Lasso? Do you do Ridge? Right? I was talking to Rahul about it. And for me, I also do non-negative matrix factorization for a genomic project. There, we have a non-convex problem. And you have multiple modes. For me, actually, each mode is a well-defined model. When you have multiple modes, you really have a class of models. I want my whatever answer to be kind of resistant or robust to which local minimum you end up with. So we actually use that idea to have a way to select number of component non-negative matrix factorization, which works very well. And now I'll show you that I have 20 models based on three versions of deep learning and Lasso, and they all give similar prediction result. So what I seek is really about only one of the data results which are supported by all 20 models, just to be on the conservative side. And you have just people do sensitivity analysis in Bayesian modeling. So there's a lot of consideration I see it as a form of model perturbation. So here, what I see in my group have been doing is kind of take machine learning. That's how I teach these days too. You might teach a statistics class. I use prediction, I do visualization, and then I do prediction as a first kind of benchmark to assess goodness of fit. And then when I have good prediction models, I kind of go back to more stability and inference instead of start with p-values and all that. And prediction is very, very easy to explain to beginners. And I think you don't need a lot of the IDness. You just need some aspect of things to be stable cross-training versus a testing. So just much, and you can do fuzzy logic prediction. You don't have to have stochastic model either. You can have your gut feeling. That's what traders do, right? So it's, and methods don't have to have a generative nature. And computation, I won't address too much here, but later I'll say we'll analyze some stochastic gradient algorithm and relate to stability. So that's most of the big data, we do one version of the other gradient method. So I'll share for the rest of the top two projects from neuroscience. The first is like data perturbation to see to bring better, I would say better smoothing parameter selection in Lasso, better than cross-validation by use cross-validation. And the second is ongoing project. Try to really do transfer learning and do neuroscience. And the guiding principle for my group is really we like to solve scientific problems and do really, really careful validation of the method before we generalize to other problems. And my students embedded in the wet labs, they spend a substantial amount of time. So we try to play a bit of the scientist. I mean, Jiang Tuke said that statisticians can play in everybody's backyard, and I've tried to go a bit in the front yard too with them, because a lot of the new data are collected in a way that it's technology moves so fast. It's not like they accumulate a lot more knowledge about understanding technology. So it's good. It's a good opportunity for us to do it with them. And a lot of the understanding for data processing from other areas actually will help them.
You can also then have all your students and postdocs get those faculty positions and make sure that everyone is doing statistics and machine learning properly in different domains.
I know, but the thing is, we don't go for a number of papers, and not, you know, actually about more than half of my students go to industry. So that's... I think the academic metric hopefully will change a bit. Really look at more substance than look at number of papers, because I think we cannot really evaluate all the papers anymore. So this project is kind of old, from 2011, and it's a collaboration with Jack Galan's lab. We have been working together for the last 10 years. I took 1 year off and stayed in his lab for a year, 2006. And Shinji now back in Japan, and Yuval back to Israel. So these are the main people. Some of you might have seen it. It was all over the news like 5 years ago. So the data is such that three human subjects were lying down under an fMRI machine. And fMRI signals were measured in different visual areas. And each voxel in the fMRI domain is actually hundreds and thousands of neurons. So it's not direct neural measurement. It's indirect. And the person was watching clips of movies from YouTube and also movie trailers. How do I play it? I don't see my cursor.
Your cursor's here. You can see it by the 14, by the page number.
Oh.
It's down.
I don't see. Oh, I see it there. I don't see it on my screen. Here you go. So on the left-hand side is the movie, the input to the brain, and this is the measurement after processing. You know, there's a lot of processing done. The red means intensive response. Blue means not so interested. So I actually use this in my Let Us Own Data Science speech to show that humans have very short attention span. We get bored very quickly. Therefore, we need new names. Because the CS people have been really good with new names, and statistics, we just keep with statistics, right? It has evolved over 100 years, and we did so many different things. Only we understand it. Everybody think we just do census or baseball statistics. So that's why I was using this to show that we need new names, otherwise people get confused. We get bored. We're not very patient. I think it's predictive coding, right? After we can predict what's going on, we just give up, and we don't have to waste the energy to figure out what's going on. Okay. So here's the result. So Jack was all over, I mean, I think NPR had the coverage, Economist had the coverage, everybody had the coverage on this work. And even the Chinese, some, I read it in China, had the coverage on this. I even got a few calls, but I got Jack to do the work. And my student got interviewed on Israeli television, and his grandfather was extremely pleased. So this is what people was surprised to see. And for me, I want to come back to this. This is basically have two steps. One is forward modeling, right? The key step is Gabor features, a 3D Gabor feature which builds on years and neuroscience, computational science work. After that, it's simple. It's some like lasso method. Okay, but the feature make that work, that was huge amount of work. And then that's the forward model. So for each focus, we had this forward model. And the reconstruction actually was very simple. So what we did that with the new data, the reconstructing data fMRI was 10 replicates. So it was a lot higher to noise to signal to noise ratio. So we just projected all the 1 million movie clips into the fMRI space and found the 100 closest to the observed. And then we did the average. Okay? So actually the posterior, you're basically treating the database of 1 million clips as like empirical prior. And we're in a 26,000 dimension after all the processing for the regression. And actually, it was not enough. That's why all the blurring. So actually, I'm thinking about going back and to do a more manifold averaging to get sharper result. But there, that's what's done. So the posterior probability is exactly what we did. Actually, decays very, very slowly. But magically, the ordering still has information. So if you take a random 100, you won't get a result. So you take the top 100, you get a result. But we don't really understand. But the numbers are not that different. So it's a mystery. We don't quite understand. So that's what it's like in engineering success. So I want to take this project and say that I want to do some neuroscience. Can I answer the question, where in the image a particular voxel is interested in? Right? This is saying that. And this is three voxels. So each gabar actually is related to a location. That's what you see. So these are the locations of the gabars, removing the frequency and the, and also the orientation and also the time. So I'm only plotting the location. So you see that CV select models that seem to suggest that this voxel A is interesting all over the place. And neuroscience, scientifically, doesn't make a lot of sense because we're pretty localized. So we developed something called ESCV, adding stability to cross-validation, which really shrank it down. Still might not be right, right? But it's a lot more reasonable. So this is more suggestive. Oh, if you want to do
so
follow-up experiment.
Presumably, you would want that when you put all the voxels together, you get support everywhere, yes?
And yes, yes. So we haven't, we're looking at each individual voxels.
Right.
In theory, we can actually test this, right? We can just start putting things here
mm-hmm.
and different features and see whether this voxel light up.
Right.
Well, we haven't gotten
them. Sort of the first one almost, well, not quite, but mm-hmm. it looks a little bit like a mixture of a local and a Fourier transform.
I mean, there's a lot of correlations, right, between the features,
yeah.
right? That's what got picked up.
Yeah.
yeah. And if you look at the prediction with the ESCV model, actually, we don't lose much prediction at all. That was a surprise. I was willing for a concise model and lose some prediction accuracy. For this data, because so much correlation, actually, we lost like 1.3% over these thousands of voxels. But the size of the model reduced by 60%. So what we did was exactly what I would call the PS workflow. We used prediction, the cross-validation selection, as the lambda. So let's just take each lambda. I look at another stability measure. I look at all the projected coefficients to the predictors and look at how much they vary from the grand average, if say you do tenfold validation. And you compare with the size. And this is really actually a test statistic. You basically look.
M is just where you left out prediction.
M is the how many times you did a cross validation. Right, because everybody has to do cross-validation usually for the suit, so we're not adding computation complexity, which is building on top of that.
No, no, but beta M means that in your
value. Oh, beta is the...
So the I mean, this,
yeah.
M just means that you left out log M.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Beta is the coefficient in my last suit. I should have no equation that I don't have. And this is, you can interpret it as testing whether X beta being zero. It's a test statistic. So what we do is that we use, as I said, I use the cross-validation selection as a goodness of fit, and then I shrink the model to a smaller one until this stability is the best locally. And that's the choice. Okay? So because if I have beta as constant, it's very stable, had nothing to do with my data. So this cross-validation choice forced me to fit real data and works. So that's where we have this ESCV. I've been using this for other projects, which tend to not always give you the same prediction error, but because by definition it's a smaller model, so always give you a more concise model. It's just easier to look at. So we tried it with a more nonlinear random forest-based model. There we can find stable high-level interactions, but you lose, there's something just noise. You can do prediction, you cannot pin them down. So there you lose prediction performance by like 10% or something. Here, we barely lost anything. So this is like data perturbation, try to go for stability. And the next project is also going for predictive and stable association for interpretability, and then hopefully we can guide intervention experiments for neuroscience. So this is, again, a project is led by my group, three people, and with Jack's lab, and Ben collected data 10 years ago. It took 2 years. So this is different data, single neuron data with behaving macaque. And Mike is a current student. So Risa is an E student, stat student, and stat student now work for Google.
Like
no, this is single neuron data, and not human either. So for the fMRI, we only use actually V1, V2. So we have two major pathways for information in visual processing. One is what, one is where. So this is the what pathway. We try to decide what we're looking at. And V1 and V2 are used for reconstruction because we don't have a good forward model for V4. So V4 is a very difficult area before IT, which is object recognition. So it's more sophisticated than edge detection, but it's not sophisticated enough to have the whole object. So people have done very controlled stimuli, like with geometric curvature, texture, so very synthetic stimuli to have some conjectures. And we're going to use natural stimuli. And on the other hand, you have all this deep learning stuff. And we didn't start with deep learning. Usually I try to stay in cold areas, but I have been drawn to the hot area. I'll tell you why. So this is kind of fringe AI. And I'm in the camp that I think humans, at least the good humans, can still do a lot more than current CNNs. And I think in my lifetime, I'm safe that the machines won't take over. I feel very happy about that. And I think the challenge for AI is actually how do you reproduce intuition and conscious brain, which is not defined. Actually, human intelligence is not well defined either. So that's the circular argument. But I do think that the future will be a human-machine collaboration, that we're already kind of doing it. So for this project, we try to answer, actually, we started from this, what do V4 neurons do? And then we end up having to touch upon this question, how much do convolution networks resemble brain function? And actually, to my surprise, I have to say that we do learn some evidence. It does capture something. So what happened was that we had this project since 2013 with Julian Merrill, Yuval Benjamini, to analyze that data. And we built our own two-layer network, use sparse coding, very simple, but worked state-of-the-art for that data set in terms of prediction. What do I mean by state-of-the-art is that we use V1 as a benchmark, how well we can do prediction for V1, and we compare for V4. That's how we compare why it's a good result. And DiCarlo's group at MIT actually has a parallel line. And they did a lot of the prediction work and published. And we had this work presented, this paper still being written, because Jack hasn't found time. and well, I protested that, you know, has been 4 years, and he said the papers took 6 years. So the price to pay to work with the top neuroscience lab. And I gave a talk at the JSM staff meeting 2 years ago, and Joshua Benjo was talking deep net. And I felt I was making my own nets. So the question is, if we just use the nets trained by image net, what will happen? So that's why I got into deep learning. To my surprise, I had my two best people on this project, so I know the result would be very hard to improve. But the deep nets improved a tiny bit. So that's how I jumped in. And DiCarlo's group had a little bit different image. They don't have complete natural image. They have this semi-natural images with object imposed on top of natural image. And they, in some sense, we're pushing so hard on interpretations because they kind of had predicted result, but it's good we replicate their prediction. Actually, it's not a bad thing that we did it independently, but we're now pushing very hard on the interpretation. So the data was 71 neurons from two macaques, and we didn't find any difference, so we put them together. It's well-isolated V4 neurons. They use this typical complex stimuli to find where are the V4 neurons. Of course, they can be wrong, but that's what they call V4 neurons. And black and white images. And we did transfer learning in three senses, I'll explain, and gained state-of-the-art prediction performance for neurons. And then we have been spending 2 years trying to get stable interpretations of our predictive models so that we think that we can characterize the neurons. So this is ImageNet, AlexNet, and it's trained on color images. And for classification tag, it's human labels. So it's transfer learning in the sense that we have black and white images, had nothing to do with the, we just use this as a black box. After people feed the ImageNet will take it as a processing box. We got the features, and we do very simple lasso or regression, and feed to vFound neuron. So this is task, very high level visual task. This is a single neuron. And this is human data. This is macaque. This is color. This is black and white. We didn't do anything. We took it and just changed the black and white image, just three channels, put the same stimuli, made it color. Right? So we didn't do any alteration. And we did reach or lasso. And we got very good result, slightly better than our self-made model. So this is already a human-machine collaboration, right? Without the labels, imaging, you know, Alex ain't going to work so well. So a lot of, I would say, crowdsourced human intelligence went into image, like AlexNet, in the ImageNet labeling. Then we have other nets, right? We have VGG, we have GoogleNet, and we have at least two regression methods. So we suddenly have six models, right? I said this is about model perturbation. And we want to see how they work in terms of prediction and visualization. And we're going to interpret only the part that 6 later we got 20 models, we look at the higher layers, gave similar results. So this is overall prediction performance. So Gabor, you can see, definitely doesn't work for V4. And after layer 2, you have many good layers give similar performance. So I'm going to concentrate on layer 2, and then I'll go for other layers mentioned. So this is lasso with three different nets. They basically give similar results. The correlation across the different models is like 0.92. And this is the data, so it's indistinguishable. And on average, reach gives the best prediction performance, but it's pretty big, 0.4 new number of parameters, and lasso shrink to about 400. One thing is that for high signal noise, you usually correct lasso with OIS, you remove bias, but for this data, there's still noise to be removed. You do reach, this become like elastic net. So this is pretty noisy data. So OIS actually hurts. Usually for higher signal noise ratio, it corrects for the bias, but for this data, you want more regularization. Lasso doesn't give enough regularization. So now we do the interpretation. So this is a particular neuron. We want to see that this basically is a readout from the models to indicate that where does this neuron care about. It's kind of tuning region. And you can see that for lasso and ridge, even lasso is quite a bit worse, 0.1 worse, they give very similar results. So we're happy to see that, oh, this is probably where this neuron care about. This is like suggestive, which is hard to interpret that this neuron cares about. There are better ones. And then cross three different nets, they also give very stable results. So now we just say that that's something we trust. And we end up using what we call manifold deep dream to characterize the neurons. So what's deep dream is that you have a fitted model, right? It's a one-dimensional function with a high-dimensional input space. And you take a random starting point, and then you just find the local minimum, and that's the image you show. So there's a lot of consistency with random starting point. I'll show you a movie. And this is the inhibitory patterns. That's where the neuron gets negative results. And here you can see that's the iteration from white noise converge to something. So it's pretty stable. And this is a different way of looking at from my group, Rebecca's work, we call superheat. It's a way to look at high-dimensional data with a response. So I'm also advertising for that, for data visualization. And this is taking the images in the database we have, black and white, find one that excites this model neuron, saying that, and you can see this. It says that it's kind of texture, but it's irregular. We cannot really say what it is. This is another neuron, which is our favorite, one of our favorite neurons. Again, lasso doesn't quite, because a neuron doesn't really jump. So we think actually ridge is biologically more meaningful. The region for a neuron to care about usually is very continuous. And lasso has a problem, sometimes sparsity and jump around. So ridge actually is better. And this is a neuron. Again, it's pretty consistent. It's in the middle. And this is the pattern. This neuron cares about curvature. This is the inhibitory neurons. And this is the movie you can see similarly. For paper, you cannot do that, so we have the superheat to show that, you know, convergence is pretty stable. So you see that nothing happens here. It's because this is the color filters, and we have black and white images, so nothing happens in that
particular. So nice, you would imagine that some very simplified way, there should be some kind of proof of convergence, right? Or, I mean, obviously not with this, but...
But
could there be a really, really simple version?
No, that's what I hope. I think for computation, the high dimension, we definitely hope everybody's trying to get a simpler version. So I'll show you some compression result, try to go that way. And this is layer 3 you've seen already. So you can see that Google Net actually has these funny features. This is use layer 3 as processing layer 4. They're not exactly the same, but the consistent, again, the consistency is this curvature. Google Net definitely has something funny there. It had this artificial, like, eye-looking things. Right, I think you have seen other deep dream images like that from Google Net, too. But that's why we look for consistency. We only say that the things are consistent. We're not going to interpret this eye-like thing because we don't see other models with the same prediction. They might be there, but we just don't have evidence to say. And for this neuron, I should have this first. For the last neuron, you can see that the image is picked up, maximizing the model neuron has a clear signature of curvature, much more clear than the other one. So this is really a curvature neuron. And there are other 8 neurons. You saw this one, you saw this one. This one, basically like a V1 neuron, is an edge detector. And it's known that some of the V4 neurons like V1. Because if, from the design point of view, it's not a good idea always to have same functionality neuron in the same place. If that part of the brain gets knocked out, you're pretty hopeless. But it's good to have redundancy. And also, it's possible that neurons might have plasticity, have multiple roles too. So you can see that they're all kind of different, but I think a characteristic. And to also compare, if you take this, we have this characterization neurons. And I give you 9 images. It's possible that neuron like all of them, because there's no reason why one neuron only likes one exact image. Maybe a group of distribution neurons excited, right? But you see that, so now we have 71 neurons, each have some characterization of the favorite pattern, and you do the cross, you can see they really prefer its own model. You see the diagonal. But this group is like similar neuron, they like similar things. And this group is like some excitatory images become inhibitory for another group. Right, so it's all present. And to kind of follow up what Jennifer was saying, that we also try to simplify things to understand. So one project by Risa is actually compression. So we use the reduction of accuracy, this is back to the 1,000 category image net, to remove filters. So we're not just removing weights, we're removing filters. And that's more effective for deep learning to work on a small device. And which one? So we're compressing more amount to 90%. You can see the pattern kind of still persist. Okay? So there's something to that. So we can remove lots of them. There's something which just show another way that there's something real there. It's not exact, but you see a certain feature occurring. We lose very little prediction accuracy. And if you look more carefully into the compression result, and you see that a lot of the filters actually we remove are the color filters. But for a lot of object detection, we don't need the color. Right, it's the shape. So you can see that makes sense. And we have another way, we submitted something to NIPS workshop, got accepted, was that we also use the classification label to give filters meanings, right? So if this filter is very important for a classification for a particular label, that it's almost saying this is this filter's functionality. So we both use visualization in the input and also the output to characterize the filters. And we really try to hope to do experiments. So I see all this work, predictability and stability, is kind of a scientific recommendation system. We want to recommend things for people to do experiments. So now we're claiming that these deep dream images are images characterizing a neuron. We can actually test it by feeding it back, because actually that's a problem. People don't know how to probe a neuron. They do synthetic ones, right? And it's not very natural. And what else do? This gives you a data-driven way of generating images to put it back into the loop and prove it. But Jack is out of physiology experiment, so I need to find another collaborator to do that. With the computing, with the fuzz, you can do it real time. So that would be really proving this. And the other thing is we can go back to, So this one's about V4, right? So we can go back to the movie project and then really improve the reconstruction, use the V4 area fMRI, which we didn't use because we didn't have a good forward V4 model. So these are the two testable experiments we could do. And the last bit is computability, right? So you have Turing machine, you have Turing computability. I'm going to take a very practical view. It's like computability means rates of convergence in iterative optimization method. Otherwise, I cannot relate the two, right? They're not computable. I tried, but I couldn't make it work. So we're looking at aggressibility, which is delete one. And there have been quite a bit of work relating these two. And also this, so this beginning some work, so we add to this link how to relate convergence rate to aggression stability. And we basically have some inequality to have the access rate bounded by stability error plus optimization error. And using stability bound and estimation bound, we can actually show that a very stable algorithm cannot converge too fast, which is completely reasonable. But you actually prove it more precise. And we then analyze some special gradient algorithms with Yuan Si and Jin Qi, and the paper is being written. So summary, I hope I give some evidence and start with predictability and go to stability. It's a good workflow to really do use machine learning and then bring back a lot of statistical considerations. And we also tried it with genomics and text mining project. The stability principle is so, you can say, vague, that there's a lot of room for people to improvise to apply to their problems. It doesn't really dictate what perturbation you do, but just force you to think what's appropriate. And that's actually a huge amount of work to really make a case. And we can end up with testable characterization neurons for follow-up experiments. And there are a lot of theory I think can be done. And I do think that with this, I do feel like CNN trained on ImageNet, especially the early layer, do capture something about prime visual processing. And I talked to some students in Berkeley. They have been trying to use ImageNet and then for radiology tasks. So they start with ImageNet, and then they do improvements for the particular task, say tumor detection. But it's kind of, you have the rough vision model from this ImageNet, and then you tune for a particular task. It's almost like you have an average human model as ImageNet, and then you tune it as a radiologist, in a way. And it's pretty amazing for a visual task, I think, because it captures something. I was surprised. I'm usually the last one to jump in hot areas, but with evidence, I did. So here's what I said, that Berkeley, we have been working on this for the last 3 years. So now we want the intellectual vision, which is the integration of CS and Stanford data science, to really have a structure to support it. And the report, 105 pages, is on my website. And the data 8 now has, in the second year, serving 1,000 students a semester, so 2,000 students. And then I was on the team with two CS and a staff faculty to design DS100 last semester. So now it's 250. And David Carter is the interim dean. And we have a new data science major in letters and science being approved. And there can be discussion for letters, like engineering also have a version of data science. So it's really quite exciting and a lot of buzz there. And these are the links. I shall thank the NSF Center for Technology that support the neuroscience work. Thank you. Questions? I've managed to finish very quickly. Yes, Andrew.
of stability that you focus on seems very closely related to this notion of regularization in some of the early work done on radial basis functions for modeling human vision, like the work of Tommy Poggio and Federico Girosi. Is that the same idea, or is there something else to it?
I think I've tried to build a platform to unify, definitely. I think, but I think the earliest reference about stability actually is rate regression, which is Tikhonov paper 1943, right? He was solving an integral equation, and he linearized it. And then he, for numerical reasons, he did the L2 penalization. So that's it's a regularization. So a lot of time, I feel like Bayesian models, I think Purdue has been doing, is kind of a form of regularization, definitely. But the thing harder for Bayesian models, I have a hard time when you have more than two layers to know how the regularization from different layers interact. So it's a little black box there, too.
But is the basic idea that you want to basically penalize some kind of...
I think it's one way doing that, but I want to be broader than that. So, for example, including the mechanistic models for the arm, right? It's, you can say it's regularization in ways like you simulate this data from the model, you're kind of pulling the data toward data, but it's not in the analytical form anymore. It's more like pulling to another cloud of data. Better than not having it, right? It's not exactly right, but pulling in that direction help you. But it's not really analytical. So I hope to be broader than just the analytical regularization. And you can also, like data fusion in a way, I would think that you can also say it's kind of a form of data perturbation, right? So try to be very broad, and then we have a common kind of language to talk about these different things. And maybe compare, right? The question is how much you have another data compared with the analytical method. Can you map them? Yeah. It just seems very very common sense, right? That's why I talked to this philosopher science colleague recently I met. Said somebody must have talked about it, right, in philosophy of science. And he said, yeah, Plato did. I said, good. That's a good person to cite. And, yes?
Can I ask a technical question about the neuro stuff that you were doing with Jack Gallant? Am I right that what you're doing is basically reconstructing by looking at it neuron by neuron or voxel by voxel, you're actually reconstructing the image that is actually perceived in the brain?
You hope. Yeah, that's the neuron...
Your reconstruction was showing that.
I'm trying to say that I did all these different things, seemed to be something stable, right? But the ultimate test is feed it back to see the neuron get excited. Right, all my images.
But aren't the images that you reconstructed...
So that's the first project.
Right, the first project.
Yeah.
You reconstructed that from looking at the voxels that were stimulated using your fMRI, right?
Yeah.
It's the bold signals.
Yeah.
You're looking at those signals, and then you're reconstructing the image based upon that.
Yeah, that's why Time magazine called mind reading.
Right.
But it's not really yet, but people got quite scared.
Why isn't it mind reading?
I just feel like there's so many other things. Attention we didn't take into account.
Well, but let me give you an example of where I think this could be mind reading. Suppose that you were doing an fMRI of a person that's sleeping and dreaming.
Yeah.
Would your method actually be able to reconstruct images of the dream?
So people had follow-up studies. Actually, they wake people up and ask them, what did you dream?
Right.
So they did do that, but it's like how much you remember, right? Because you never know exactly, but you can get quite close. But I think the precision has to be improved.
That was pretty precise to me.
You think so? But for human figures, because there are a lot of YouTube clips, people like to talk to the camera, so that's why we do the best. So if we only concentrate on human talking to the camera, I think we can do a lot better. But, yeah.
For example, you're interested between a person and a building.
Yeah, well, and also like a blob of animal or something,
right.
Yeah. But yeah.
You can't distinguish whether you dream of your spouse or somebody else.
No, that's true. but let me...
Cheater detector, huh?
What if we read about a paper where you were actually able to demonstrate that you can use this method to detect whether or not somebody was dreaming about a car, a building, you know, blobs moving in a particular way. Even that would be extraordinary, don't you think?
Yes, but I think we're not there yet, the precision. I think definitely it caused a lot of interest, I think, of people. But I don't know. I mean, on one hand, I'm very curious to see go there. On the other hand, I'm kind of scared to go there. So I start working on V4 neurons. And GX group moved down to like a text, audio, and image, and more like. So nobody seemed to want to really kill that application. I think the implications can be quite scary. Yeah, so we chose. But I kind of want to improve the precision. But that's why people were so surprised you can go that far. As I told you, it's pretty simple. Of course, a lot of things after you do it, it's pretty simple. But ahead of time was quite surprising. But without the 1 million movie clips, would that have been possible? It's kind of the prior visual experience like stored in that 1 million. But in 26,000 dimension, 1 million just disappears. So if we have a lot, we need a lot more to really, we can do the more money. Because everybody's, in 26,000 dimension, nobody's close to anybody else. You're just very far away. So you do this very average, which is not visually appealing. So I think I start looking at that problem again because I think there might be a better way to combine things.
Well, if you take a look at the hippocampus and look at the layered structure, there's, five layers there. And so you have a tremendous capacity to store a library of these movies that you're drawing from.
So yeah, and a lot of time actually subconscious. So we kind of like a camera taking everything in. And I'm always surprised. Sometimes I see something and something came back from my childhood. I felt like I never thought about for decades and just come back.
So is it clear that the image, when I look at an image and then what you see with the NMRI, is it clear that my brain pattern looks actually the same if I now project an image from my memory back into my... Because one would sort of come from the cortex and sort of level 1, 2, 3 of your neural net, if you want, and now I'm asking when I sort of imagine an image, will it actually look the same? Do you have any evidence that's the case?
I think people probably done study on it. I don't know on top of my head. But I think people probably study that question. Like, what's from your memory recall? I don't know.
You can do that very easily in your setup right now. Put a subject in the MRI and then ask them to recall an image of a bear. And then do your voxel analysis and see whether or not you can reconstruct that image from their visual cortex.
Yeah, but bear is very vague. You can try that, but if you don't find anything, it doesn't mean that they couldn't do it, right? Because bear, your past experience come in.
You could much easier, right? You could sort of say, I have 10 images. One is the red face in the right, and sort of one is the car, and sort of, and you ask them to look at the image, and then you put the images away and say, please recall the image of the car.
Yeah, that's more precise. Yeah, well, we need money to use the fMRI machine. Usually it's not in a statistic budget, yeah. But yeah, I think I would ask them, somebody might have, I'll be very surprised people haven't done that. Yes?
Is there an assumption that for each, a person, so in our conscious brain, we think about an image in our mind and we imagine there's only one image in our mind at a time. But when you are thinking about something and you get sidetracked and you start thinking about something else, there's some moment when you have two things in your head. The neurons have fired when you were thinking about whatever you were previously thinking about, and then some new neurons are firing. And that's a synaptic response, so this response is receding as the other one is raising, so there is some sort of mixture model happening. So I'm just wondering if you've considered this at all, because perhaps something you could be picking up that adds noise is concurrent thought. I mean, people say that our auditory complex can only think of one language at a time, so like someone can't be speaking to you and someone else, and you write something. Some people can do this, but there's a lot of work that shows that you only sort of have one processor. But I don't know for sort of subconscious thought or just in our own mind when we think about experiences or images, and we're trying to reflect that in an image from the brain. If perhaps you can be picking up two separate images firing, and especially as we're changing thought or thinking about new things,
Definitely, it's a possibility. We haven't dealt with that. But I think the bigger problem is actually attention. Sometimes you stare at the screen, actually you relate to what you're saying, think about something else. And there's some attention tracker which we don't have an experiment. So I think that's a bigger problem. Often you just, your mind went off, right? You're looking at it, but you're really not seeing it. So at V4, the attention definitely play a role, right? But I think what you were saying, that I felt like you need a lot more precise measurement than we have to be able to decouple. Yeah, I think, I don't know, people are talking about 7T, but it seems it hasn't been really, because you have this trade-off. I haven't heard people using 7T machine, right? Let's try to get, it just seems to be hard to make it work. It's very sensitive. So I think with more precise or maybe multi-mode measurements or something, but I think the data we have, I think would be very hard to be able to see an effect. That's just my guess. But it's definitely, a lot of times maybe the model doesn't work is because this person just spaced out, right? They have been there for 2 hours, right? Who's going to, even they fixated, they are actually graduates, you know. It's like, who's going to fix it for that long, right? Maybe they just got tired, right? Actually, we can maybe see this. Things get worse or something. When we have better experiment data, I think in theory we could do that, but for this data, I think it would be very hard to find. Interesting idea.
Okay, so let's thank Ben again.
Thank you.